I will talk about things related to transplacular physics, but a very different approach. So a lot of what we've heard at this meeting was based on the hypothesis that inflation took place. And if inflation took place, then indeed, all the physical wavelength of all modes that we observe today started out on transplacular scales. And so therefore, there's this transplacular question or problem, a window of opportunity. But what I'll be talking about today is a different approach in which you will have no inflation, in which scales that we observe today will never be Planck length. Their physical wavelength will always be at least 1 millimeter, way beyond the Planck scale. And nevertheless, we will have a mechanism to generate a scale invariant spectrum of adiabatic fluctuations.
Ruben, I don't understand you right there. I mean, there are waves today of wavelength shorter than a millimeter.
No, but I'm saying that the wavelength of the modes that we observe today in the microwave background.
Oh, those in the microwave background. It sounded like you were saying.
I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't specific enough. Those correspond to L smaller than 1,000.
Oh.
So the wavelength of those waves, always was greater or equal to about 1 millimeter. So, the material is taken from 4 papers, and here are the hepTH numbers, and the names of the co-authors. Justin Curry is involved in the last paper, and the title of the talk is String Gas Cosmology and Structural Formation. The outline of the talk is as follows. I will start with defining string gas cosmology. I will spend a lot of the time on how to extract fluctuations, both the scalar-metric fluctuations, the cosmological perturbations, and the tensor fluctuations, the gravitational waves. In this part B, you will see that there's going to be a prediction for observations as opposed to just a post-diction. And then I'll end with, with comments, and depending on how much time I'll have, there'll be either extended or shorter set of comments. And one thing I will definitely address in the comments section is a very recent paper that appeared last Tuesday, by Kalloper, Kaufmann, Lindner, and Mukhanov, attacking this entire approach. And I will tell you why you should completely discount this attack, why it's completely unfounded, why it's based on throwing out the baby with the bathwater. And I hope to get to that fairly soon. And for the few of you who were at the Paris meeting 2 months ago, 25 years of inflation, they'll notice a subtle change in my tone, the way that I speak about that. And this subtle change in my tone is due to this recent paper by Colin Bernard. So if they think that they've made us shut up, they certainly have not achieved it. Go. So I'll start with defining string gas cosmology. And I should say from the very beginning that this is a toy model. So we give up on the attempts to do something where we base our, where we start with the Einstein intuition at low energies and then try to extrapolate to higher energies using some effective field theory techniques. So we are developing a toy model which is supposed to work top-down. And you will not get this toy model just by starting from the Einstein action at low energies and extrapolating upwards. But again, the problem is that it's a toy model. It is not string cosmology, but it is a toy model of something that might emerge from string theory, but it might also not emerge from string theory. It is based on some guiding principles. And the guiding principles are to use new degrees of freedom and new symmetries. So by new, I mean degrees of freedom or symmetries which are not contained in field theory, which are key to string theory. And let's look at these degrees of freedom first. And to do that, I'll imagine that space is a torus. All dimensions of space are toroidal with a radius r. So in that case, strings have momentum modes. And a momentum mode will correspond to the center of mass motion of the string around the torus. And the energy of the momentum modes is quantized in units of 1 over r, second the string length equal to 1. Then the strings have oscillatory degrees of freedom. Which again, point particles do not have because point particles have no internal structure. Their energy is independent of r. And then you have the winding modes. The string can actually wind around the torus. This is again, these are degrees of freedom which particles do not have. Their energies are quantized in units of r. So these are the new degrees of freedom, the oscillatory modes and the winding modes. And the symmetry that I've been making use of is key duality, which is the statement that if you replace r by 1 over r, again in string units, and at the same time you interchange the momentum and winding quantum numbers, that then the spectrum of the free mass states is unchanged. As Rob could explain, the vertex operators are unchanged under this key duality. And if you assume, if you postulate that key duality is a symmetry of non-perturbative string theory, then you derive the existence of brains, as you can read up in Polchinski's book. So there's good evidence that key duality, oscillatory modes, and winding modes are central also to non-perturbative string theory. So what we will be doing is developing a toy model, only a toy model, which is based on these new degrees of freedom and these new symmetries. Okay. So first of all, I want to do an adiabatic consideration. So I want to imagine that I have a string gas in thermal equilibrium, and I will slowly change the radius. And I follow the temperature of this string gas. So now the fact that the number of oscillation modes of a string increases exponentially with the energy, that leads to a maximal temperature for a string gas, the so-called Hagedorn temperature. So if you take a large space, large torus with a string gas, low temperature, and you slowly decrease the radius, the temperature will initially increase, but eventually when you approach this maximal temperature, the increase of the temperature will stop. Instead of the modes, the fixed number of modes becoming hotter, what will happen is that you will dump the energy into more and more different modes. And now what happens that once you let the radius go below 1 in string units, nice and symmetrically, the temperature will decrease again. And depending on how much entropy you have in your universe, this phase where you have approximately constant temperature will last longer.
Yes. Do this string interact in this scenario?
In order to maintain thermal equilibrium, you have to have interactions. So what happens is that Here, all the energy is in the momentum modes. Gradually, the energy is drifting into the oscillatory modes. And in order to do that, you have to have weak interactions.
You're making use of the ideal gas approximation.
Yeah, ideal gas approximation.
So they're interacting, but they're not interacting.
But at such a high energy, is close to regular energy, then the interactions of strength are a little bit subtle, and they will lead to creation of new strength.
Right. So I'm doing thermodynamics.
They're inelastic.
Right. Okay. So let's make a list of concerns. So list of concerns. Open string production. I was starting with a closed string gas, and as you point out, at high energies you get brains and therefore it's an open string. So there will be many more things that will be added to this list of caveats. Okay.
You don't have shelf of gravitation between the elements, among the elements of the string.
We will come to that.
So because then the Hagedorn thing gets upset.
Yeah.
Can you remind us what is the dimensionful constant that makes duality work?
That's a length, string length.
It is the same which governs the Hagedorn temperature?
Yes.
You mean same unit? Or because you said it's central. So isn't there a kind of...
So the length scale
that Hagedorn temperature will be centered about the duality, so to speak. That is that you can approach it going from the left and from the right from your diagram.
Yes, but I guess I don't understand your question. So the Hagedorn temperature is given by the string length, and I'm measuring lengths in string units.
It might be numerical coefficient. T duality is an exact symmetry.
So, well, there are some pies that appear on the Hagedorn temperature.
You can drag it on from the left or from the right. If there is a numerical coefficient, which is not one, you can deduce in one case. Do you always end up?
Okay, but then, in terms of the temperature, there will never be any temperatures higher than the Hagedorn temperature. So let me continue. So let's imagine that there's some dynamics.
Robert, one more question for you. As you increase the temperature, can the winding numbers change, or are they topologically protected?
The net winding number is topologically protected. However, what can happen, and this is a process I'll get to, you can have two winding strings, and they can annihilate producing two loops. And this is the way that you dump energy from the winding modes into radiation. This process is actually going to be important.
And the reverse?
The reverse will happen as we go this direction.
So
this error will happen if you go forwards. So let's imagine that there's some dynamics that tells us how R changes as a function of time. Then you will see that you expect such a time temperature curve. Something very different from what your intuition tells us. Okay. Now another key feature, if you sit here, it should be equally likely that a dynamical fluctuation sets you off in this direction and in this direction. Now let's imagine that you apply the Einstein action to this consideration, to this configuration here. Then you would only go forwards. So the lesson you learn is that if you want to have a background action that correctly characterizes this feature, this key feature to string thermodynamics, it is definitely not going to be the Einstein action. Definitely. We don't know what it's going to be, but it's not going to be the Einstein action. So therefore, any criticisms of our scenario which are based on Einstein action are obviously not
Can you simply repeat it? Sorry.
So here, you see that Einstein, let me repeat it, but in different words. Mm-hmm. So whatever action that you have that describes the background evolution, that should manifest this, this duality symmetry. The Einstein action does not.
So you say it's incompatible with T duality.
Yeah. It's incompatible with T duality.
I'm a bit confused on the definition of R. Is this an internal variable concerning the string, or is
No, that's
external space.
Right. So now comes a big caveat. Is that we have to have a completely artificial separation between background. And string matter. This is why this is a toy model. But we have a classical background. Classical background involves space, unfortunately.
And R.
And R is a radius of the space. Each spatial dimension is a toroid.
All of them.
Symmetric. We want to start nice and symmetric. And if I were to give two talks here, then I would actually let all nine dimensions start out with the same radius. Today, what I will do is I will keep six of them compact at the string length forever.
I think that's always confusing the string theory. When you have a closed string, then you talk about an internal space in the string, like this sigma variable.
See, the sigma variable, it labels this direction.
Yes.
So this, if R is macroscopic, then this is actually a cosmic superstring, because it is also macroscopic in length.
Okay. Can you say in more detail? I mean, you said that the Einstein action doesn't show this symmetry, can you say a few more words?
Right. Okay. So if you apply the Einstein action and you stick in a string gas with this equation of state, which actually corresponds to P equals zero, pressureless at this point, then the Einstein action will tell us that there are two modes, growing mode and a decaying mode. The growing mode will dominate, the universe is going to expand very, very rapidly. So
let me be confused, and I'll share my confusion. If I compactify this, if I did a reduction, a Kluze-Klein reduction, I would have said the size of the scalar, or the size of that internal dimension, if I just do one circle, is governed by...
Oh, but you see, these are going to be the R dimensions.
Fine.
But
we're going to do one.
Okay.
So if I had, it would be governed by a scalar field, but it would just be a massless scalar field. And the action is T duality invariant. If phi goes to minus phi, is a symmetry of that action. So I'm not sure how that jives with what you just told me. That Einstein picks out one direction over the other.
Well, you agree.
You're assuming something else, or you're adding something else, but I'm not sure.
Well, I'm not doing... See, what you're doing is you are taking the entire space and replacing it by a scalar field. But it's, you're replacing it by a quantum mechanical variable if you're compactifying all space dimensions. Basically, what I'm saying is that that's not Kaluza-Klein reduced.
Right.
We described the background in terms of a metric. The equation that determines the metric cannot, the action that determines the background metric cannot be the Einstein action.
But the background metric that you're going to choose at the end of the day is just going to be some diagonal metric, and it's only going to depend on T.
Yes, correct.
So, well, we can talk about it later. I would think that that's within the regime of what I'm doing. Just saying that there is a way to parameter, if I want to describe the system with one circle, there's a way to parameterize that in which the resulting action displays this T duality symmetry.
Yes, I agree with that, and I'll show you a way to do it.
Okay.
I'll show you a way to do that.
If you repeat the duality, if you're taking a big cosmic string that goes all around the universe, and you make this duality transformation, then you're converting it into a microcosm.
I see the symmetry here. If you permit a naive question, just to ensure that maybe the grad students can follow. There's this obvious symmetry in Lonar temperature space. And we're saying that these are the only state variables of this cosmology. In other words, this symmetry is the only thing that we can come from.
This is the motivation. This is the motivation. Now I'll build something that should include this physics.
Right. Well, what I was asking is simply, we say that the Einstein action is invalid here because it doesn't respect that symmetry. Mm-hmm. But all that's saying is that it favors one direction over the other.
Yep.
Which has to say that these are the only state variables we're concerned with.
Let me continue a little bit and then see if you still have a question. Because the next step is going to be a background action which does have this symmetry and which reduces to the Einstein action at large values of the radius. Okay. And this is Dilaton gravity. So the background action, the first background action that I will be using is that of Dilaton gravity. S is d for x, square root of minus g, e to the minus 2 phi. Phi is a dilaton. Okay. So now what I do is I'm doing cosmology. So I stick in a homogeneous and isotropic metric. A dilaton field, which is again homogeneous and isotropic. I define new variables, logarithm of the scale factor, and a rescaled dilaton field. And from this action, I think I have space to write the equations of motion. I get three equations of motion, the two analogs of the Friedmann-Robertson-Walk equations, plus the dilaton equation of motion. So 3 lambda dot square plus phi dot square. So this is the 0-0 Einstein equation. E is a total energy of the string gas. So we stick in matter. Matter is a string gas. So the action, we use a hydrodynamical action for matter. The equation of state given by that of a string gas. Total energy E, total pressure P. So these are the equations of motion which follow from this action. And now we do some observations.
Maybe what we were talking about was just semantics. When you said Einstein action, that literally meant just the Einstein action without
yes.
the dilaton.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I take back what I said about dilaton.
Okay. I thought there was some.
You probably said this before, but we're sort of assuming the other six dimensions are stable, and so there's no
yes.
degree of freedom associated with the volume of this.
That's, but it would be trivial to include those.
Yeah,
we've done it.
I agree.
Just to shorten the discussion.
Sure. Yeah.
So let's do some observations. And I do these observations because what I want to do is to start with the equations and take our universe back in time, assuming that we have a string gas and we have these equations. And then see what kind of an interesting state we get. So first of all, you see that if the pressure is positive, then you have a force preventing expansion. Whereas if you have negative pressure, sorry, the other way around. Negative pressure prevents expansion because you have a confining potential for the scale factor. Whereas if you have positive pressure, it prevents contraction. So now you see that if we apply this logic to the internal dimensions, we get automatically radion stabilization at the self-dual radius. And so that would be this previous talk, which I could have given, is how you get radion stabilization. Good. Now, at r equals 1, you will have equilibrium between momentum and winding modes. So the momentum modes have positive pressure. Winding modes have negative pressure, tension, negative pressure. At the self-dual radius, you have an equal number of momentum and winding modes, and therefore zero pressure.
By R, you mean a scale factor?
By R, I mean the actual radius of the torus of space in spring units. You can replace it. You can relate it to the scale factor.
Can you explain why a winding mode has negative pressure?
Yeah, it's like an elastic band. We are talking about a relativistic string. Tension is negative pressure, like for a cosmic string.
The T-duality should be manifested in...
Yes, it's manifest, and T-duality is manifest if you let phi go to minus phi, and at the same time r goes to 1 over r. That's T-duality. So this action has a T-duality symmetry. Okay, so at r equals 0, you basically have an attractive fixed point of these equations, with lambda equals constant. This is the Hagedorn phase. And it is quasi-static. Lambda equals constant, static. Quasi-static, not everything is static. Phi is decreasing as it increases. So, this is observation one, observation two, and observation three is if you set P equals 1/3 E, radiated equation of state, then phi is equal to constant. Which means, and then the two other equations reduce to the usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker equation. So now, based on these observations, I will take our universe back into the past.
Phi
will be a constant.
Well, that's the only solution.
What happens is that the equation of motion for phi will be a damped oscillator without driving force. And so the fact that lambda is increasing, that will damp any pre-existing motion of phi. So what I'll do now is I'll just take our universe back into the past and then evolve it back into the future. Then you'll see the dynamics. So, as a function of time, I will have both the scale factor and the temperature, which I'll plot. So we start in the radiation-dominated Friedman. The temperature approaches the Hagedorn temperature. Energy, so here we have P equals 1/3 rho, E. Energy drifts into the winding modes. You smoothly make a transition to P equals 0. The scale factor comes to rest, and the dilaton starts increasing as we go back in time. So scale factor is decreasing in the radiation-dominated phase. It comes to a halt. So this is the cosmology that emerges, taking our universe back into the past.
So the scale factor is absolutely normalized? That is the A naught, the...
Yeah, you could have said, I could have said R too.
It's really R.
It's really R.
And it's one, not whatever.
Yep.
String
framework. This is a string framework. I'll talk about the Einstein framework in a while.
So by measuring the temperature today, we know what is the radius of the universe?
No, we do not. Because it depends on the total entropy. So if we know the temperature and the entropy, we know the radius. Because you see, if you take fixed temperature, depending on the high entropy, low entropy, you get different power.
Sorry, now I don't understand what are the blue and the white line there. What changes?
Those are curves with more or less matter entropy.
Matter?
Matter entropy, string gas entropy.
So you mean the string gas with a fixed entropy?
So let's start the universe at a fixed size. We can put lots of strings in that fixed volume, or much less strings. And then we get these two different curves.
Oh, but wait, if you have a fixed temperature, then you should be able, from on the basis of the temperature, to generate a certain gas, even if there wasn't one.
No, if you give me the volume, yes.
Yes. Oh, I see, so this is, so whether white or blue is a question of volume?
Or density. Entropy density. Special entropy density.
It depends on how many species, or how can you change the entropy?
Well, I view it very programmatically. You start universe large, you either dump a lot of strings into this initial volume, or a few strings.
Well, basically, you're out of equilibrium. Because if you are in equilibrium, then for fixed temperature, fixed volume, you expect to fix
the entropy. This is why I asked the question. There's an equation.
If you have a black box at a fixed temperature, then you can tell it.
In your paper with Rafa, you had mentioned that in 10 years, 15 years ago, you had mentioned that things are not very normal thermodynamic, things are not extensive.
Yeah,
entropy is not changing.
That's
peculiar to strings. That's how they behave.
Why intuition?
Well, let's just stick with this intuition that you start with a fixed volume and then you throw a few strings into it or a lot of strings and then you get these different curves.
When you say string, Robert, when you say string,
you have to have a non-spectral that goes like e to the n. I think
that as long as you can treat the string perturbatively, this is a statement about the perturbative degrees of freedom of the string.
The black hole entropy after a while.
That's, you see, I'm also. So the thermodynamics is thermodynamics on a fixed background. And if you allow the background to be perturbed, then the issue might be different. Although I have something to say about that, the drawbridge.
I was just wondering, when you said strings, do you mean effectively winding number? Is that what you're changing between those curves? But there's more winding strings in them, or
here it's more momentum.
It's more momentum.
Momentum. Okay.
No, but since there are interactions, as we have here between all those modes, can you don't you expect that at a fixed temperature, there is one state, just one state, which maximizes the entropy? So how can I, at a fixed temperature, change the entropy if there is one equilibrium state?
One equilibrium state?
Yeah, ensemble, and not many ensembles.
Well, if so, for fixed initial conditions, you're right. Anyway, the fact that I have two different curves will not end.
Okay.
So let's, can we focus on one curve?
No, it did for my question. Measuring the temperature today, do we measure the actual size of the universe, if there is? And for that, you need many entropistic.
Right. What I will be doing is I will be evolving our universe back in time, given temperature today. Actually, I will be starting at the transition between at the time of equal matter and radiation.
Very good.
And then I'll be working backwards in time. And I'll be starting with the temperature that we infer at equal matter and radiation, and with the size of the universe, which corresponds to our present Hubble volume. And then I work backwards, assuming that the Hubble temperature corresponds to the grand unified temperature, and I find that this radius here is about 1 millimeter.
Can I ask a naive question? What does speed duality imply for the closed character of our three-dimensional sections? Do you have to conceive our universe as a closed universe?
Okay, so you're now saying, what happens? How does is there key duality if space is not toroidal? That's a question you're asking.
Yeah.
Now, you see, that's key duality is a fairly complicated symmetry, and others in the audience know much more about that than me. There is a generalization of that, but you see, what I need is I need that the winding modes be long-lived. That's crucial. And so therefore, I need something that has cycles, one cycles. So I need to have manifolds which have one cycles, or manifolds for which it would take strings a long time to unwrap if there are no stable one cycles. So that's a condition on the manifold that I need. So let me continue. I see if you're not convinced.
No, it's not that I'm not convinced, I don't understand. It's simpler.
Okay. So, 1 millimeter.
But 1 millimeter is the self-dual radius.
Okay, good. Thanks for asking that question. So now, in order to have 1 millimeter, in order to have P equals 0 at 1 millimeter, I need unequal number of momentum and winding modes.
Sorry, are you putting in the 1 millimeter or are you getting it out?
No, I'm putting in. So, concern, where does this 1 millimeter come from? That's called the entropy problem. And if I have time at the end, I will give you a way how to solve the entropy problem. So one of the things that inflation does is it produces a large universe almost automatically, if you accept all the things that go into inflation. We have to put in a 1 millimeter size space to start out.
So the winding and momentum modes don't equilibrate. There's your extra parameter to winding and thermal ensemble.
Yeah, I guess so.
The ratio.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah. So it's almost done.
So just correct, 1 millimeter is input, and that's the self-dual radius?
No, 1 millimeter is input. It says if we take if we follow our universe with the presently observed Hubble radius back into the past to a temperature of about grand unification temperature, then the physical wavelength of our patch of the universe is 1 millimeter. So, if you want, sorry.
Is this a computation?
That's a computation. Trivial computation.
Can you show the computation?
Yeah, I don't want to lose time on that. So basically.
So it's not input, it's determined by retrodiction.
That's what it is, yes.
From present conditions.
But remember, I put this caveat here. In order to develop this scenario, we need an input, an ad hoc input. And this ad hoc input is we need the size of this space at Hagedorn density. We need this to be at least 1 millimeter. Otherwise, we can solve all of the equations, and we get a universe today which is much too small.
So this 1 millimeter is irrespective of the proper volume of our universe, not our visible universe.
No, no, the 1 millimeter says it's a minimal size. We need to produce at least.
It's at least, okay.
It must be at least 1 millimeter. Now, it's our predictions, input.
1 millimeter is mentioned in the context of checking the gravitational force flow.
Okay, I don't know if there's any.
It's a coincidence.
I think it's a complete coincidence. Complete. And you see, I'm also not. And also, you change the Hagedorn temperature. And as you decrease the Hagedorn temperature, this number of 1 millimeter goes up.
Sorry, one more question. It's 1 millimeter, whatever the string scale is? Or?
Yes. Because it comes from just standard cosmology. The entire input is usual Friedman equations in the radiation-dominated epoch. Because this evolution is usual Friedman equations. So there's no mystery in this 1 millimeter. Okay, so now, if you want to interpret what's happening here in terms of Einstein gravity, then what you see is the universe is static, h is zero, h is positive, h dot is positive, energy conditions violated. This is not a problem. This has to be the case. Has to be the case. If you start with this picture, any realization of this picture from the point of view of Einstein gravity has to have a violation of whatever the energy condition is. So, I mean, I'm stressing that because Carlo and others are big deal.
We're confused about the 1 millimeter. So you're not saying that R will tend to a constant in the past, which is 1 millimeter, right? You're saying.
No, I'm saying.
So
I'm saying.
We're confused. So I thought you were saying that when you get to 1 millimeter, the temperature flattens out near the Hagedorn temperature. But then if you keep looking back in the past, temperature would not change much, but R would change.
No, because lambda is constant.
Maybe I'm confused, but I thought you said lambda was constant in the solution when the pressure is zero, that happens at the cell dual.
Pressure is zero here. We're in the Hagedorn phase.
Can I ask the next question? What is the general layout of this universe? Just to see how it looks like.
Penrose diagram, actually.
You have A of T, it should be possible to draw the Penrose. Just what is the causal structure of this? Does it has a.
I will draw space time diagrams, not exactly Penrose diagram, but drawing space time diagrams are going to be crucial for fluctuations. So can I postpone that for that? Okay, so now something else. You see, in this phase, we know what the dilaton is today because the dilaton determines Newton's constant. The dilaton is not too small today. The dilaton is increasing as we go back in time. So there are two important times in this problem. T sub r, and that's a transition from p equals 1/3 e to p equals 0. Pressure equals 0, pressure equals 1/3 energy density. And then there's a time t sub c when the actual dilaton is 0. And once you reach this time, you obviously cannot trust this action anymore, because we enter the strongly coupled string phase. So this period here is what we call the strongly coupled Poisson phase. This period here is a weakly coupled Poisson phase.
Why does phi 1 0 on some point?
See, you take these equations, you solve them for pressure equals 0, and then you find and you write out in terms of the actual dilaton as opposed to the rescaled dilaton, and you find that fixed dilaton is not the solution. So it follows from these three equations.
But you said that in this regime, that action is no longer valid.
Here, the action is valid. Mm-hmm. So you're asking, why does the dilaton become zero? The dilaton is small here. It is increasing as we go back in time.
Okay.
So we can trust this effect of action, but not beyond this point.
Okay.
And what we are going to assume now is we are going to assume that in this strongly coupled phase, the dilaton is constant. So the system is completely set. That's an assumption.
Can you say a few more words on this, the fact that the winding modes and the momentum modes haven't equilibrated in this, well, weakly coupled phase where I assume we're going to do a lot of interesting physics? I would have just thought that I'm at the Hagedorn temperature, actually most of the energy is going to be in oscillation modes. That's where the huge density of states is.
Right.
And I would have thought that at that temperature, just the thermal ensemble would wipe out any small...
No, actually, see, this is actually not what happens in
okay.
Cosmic string simulations confirm this. What actually happens is that in the Hagedorn phase, most of the energy is in the long strings. A small fraction of the energy is in the loops. And the equations that cosmic strings obey is the same equations that derive from the Nambu-Goto action. The only difference is that the interaction, as you know very well, the interaction depends on the action dilaton.
Right.
But so if you take the, if you for a moment set the dilaton to a constant, then we know from numerical simulations of cosmic strings and from string statistical mechanics, we know that most of the energy is in the long strings.
But that doesn't contradict the statement that most of the energy is in the oscillatory mode.
No, I'm saying most of the energy, but most.
Well, that long string
okay.
isn't necessarily
yes.
a straight string that stretches
yes.
across the in its ground state.
Yes.
In fact, it will not.
Yes.
And so
but
I'm
you
just. Well, okay. Maybe we can talk about
that. So there can be a dominant fraction of the energy can be in the oscillatory modes without disrupting any of these considerations.
So D equals
0. P equals 0. Because it would be mass. Mass of particles, P equals 0. So the statement that P is equal to 0 here is consistent with most of the energy actually being in the oscillatory modes which are at rest. Good. So, anyway, so this is now the background. And what I will do now is to draw you a couple of space-time diagrams, but not Penrose diagrams, unfortunately. Simpler diagrams. So let me draw time and space, co-moving coordinates. This is a temperature T sub R. This is a temperature T sub C. And what I will draw, the Hubble radius, inverse expansion rate. And I will make a drawing in the string frame, which is the frame that I've been using throughout. Well, the universe is static. Hubble radius goes to infinity. So now I will draw fixed co-moving scales. Scale K1, scale K2. So, if we look at the evolution of scales, co-moving scales in this background, we find that scales emerge on the sub-Hubble scale. They go outside the Hubble radius. In the expanding phase, the modes are squeezed, like inflation, they re-enter.
So again, the slope of this extremely horizontal line in the usual phase?
That depends on the strength of this interaction process. Where did that go? Okay, I'll put it, this is this one. How fast does this process occur? Because it's this process which determines the drifting of the modes away from the winding modes. So the time scale of this process sets this slope. And you'll see that that will set the slope of the spectral tilt.
Yeah.
So of cosmological perturbation.
So fluctuations are produced when we have transition from hyperbolic phase to the variation phase.
Wait for 1 minute on that. Let me erase this, and I will read. I will draw the corresponding diagram for inflation. So this is now inflation. There's the time T sub r, which is reheating. Hubble radius. In inflation, the universe is expanding exponentially in the inflationary phase. Wow. Yeah, the physical length.
So to conform, it will be simpler.
Yeah, I know. But I prefer simpler for you, but not simpler for me.
It will be the same as the one you just hold. It will be identical.
Yes. Okay, identical. That's very good. So therefore, you conclude that a lot of the predictions will be the same. But there are differences. And one difference is that in this phase, any classical matter is exponentially diluted. And so you're left with the quantum vacuum of matter. And so it is quantum vacuum fluctuations which are producing what we see today. Here we have a static universe. We have a string gas. So the source of fluctuations in this model is going to be classical string thermodynamic fluctuations. So the origin of fluctuations is going to be different. So now if you were to forget about the word string and just calculate the thermodynamic fluctuations of gas of particles, you'd get a spectrum which is completely different from scale invariant. It turns out that if you calculate the spectrum of string matter fluctuations, you get a scale invariant spectrum.
Is it near Gaussian as well?
Yes.
Why?
Central limit theorem. And it is coherent. Okay. But I want to stress that anyway, because all modes are squeezed in the same way that they're squeezed during inflation. Therefore, unlike in the theory of cosmic strings and structural formation, you get, provided you manage to produce the scale invariant spectrum, you automatically get the acoustic oscillations.
Okay. The question of how that string gas couples to the ordinary matter to produce fluctuations we see. I mean, you say that you can compute a spectrum when it's all strings, but it has to somehow be imprinted on.
Yes, it has to be imprinted to the metric fluctuations. So the logic is we are going to start deep in the Hubble phase with matter fluctuations. We are going to compute the metric fluctuations as scales exit the Hubble radius, because on scales larger than the Hubble radius, gravity dominates. It's a metric that pulls the matter round. Scales smaller than the Hubble radius, it's a matter that determines the metric fluctuations. And then what we'll find is we'll find a scale round spectrum of metric fluctuations at late times.
So are you leaning heavily on the fact that these strings, because they came from a thermal distribution dominated by what Rob was referring to, all this the microscopic modes of the string, that it's all that, all the kinks at all scales of the string, of a given string, that translate into the scale invariant spectrum of metric perturbations?
I will use a particular property of the specific heat of a string gas. That's going to be the key. Okay. So now let's look at the physics from the point of view of the Einstein frame. So at late times, the Einstein frame and the string frame are the same because the dilaton is constant. At times before TC, the string frame and the Einstein frame are identical because the dilaton is constant. The only thing that changes is that, oops, TCC, this is not. In the string frame, this is the picture of Hubble radius. So now,
did you assume that dilaton is constant during hydrogen?
During the strongly coupled Hagedorn phase, dilaton is assumed to be constant. That's the thing that gives me this.
How do you justify it?
Assumption. You can make some fancy words. Consistent with the fact that deep in the Hagedorn phase, I don't want to have any preferred direction forwards or backwards. That should also be true for the dilaton.
Can I ask a question? I don't understand how the time at which the mode exits the horizon can be time dependent, because we can view it as the intrinsic properties of the node. We say when the mode stops oscillating, that is when there is a growing and a decaying mode. Right. How can this depend on the frame I'm using?
Different matters coupled differently to different types of matter coupled to minimally to different metrics. And so matter that couples minimally to the metric in the Einstein frame will freeze out corresponding to the Einstein frame Hubble radius. Matter which couples minimally to gravity in the string frame will freeze out, stop oscillating.
So they are not the same mode. That is, the mode equation for the blue line is not the same.
Well, the blue lines are the scales.
No, but
now you ask if when does different stuff freeze out? Stringy matter freezes out here.
So there are different degrees of freedom.
Different degrees of freedom. No, different degrees of freedom freeze out at different times. Do you buy that argument?
No, I thought you were describing the same mode, the same mode fluctuation.
No, here I'm just drawing scale. That was an excellent question.
Yeah, Einstein modes and string modes.
Yeah. They freeze out at different times.
During inflation, one gets an scaling variant because Hubble parameter is decreasing, and it is decreasing in a very slow manner. But here, if you use the same analogy of inflation, you see here Hubble parameter is like dropping very fast.
Yeah.
So one wouldn't expect it.
Correct. You wouldn't expect the scaling answer. Okay. So what we do. Now we will compute the metric fluctuations. So what we do is we write down a form for the metric which includes the perturbations. And it includes both gravitational waves and the scalar metric fluctuations. I work in conformal time. I choose a particular coordinate system that makes the scalar metric fluctuations look simple, diagonal. So this metric, this is a background scale factor, scalar metric fluctuations. Hij, transverse traces, the Gram-Pichons. So this is the metric that we use. And then we can write down the Einstein equations. Or if you work in the the Einstein equations, the dilaton gravity version. And what you do is you use the 0-0 equation, and that will tell us how this phi is related to the delta rho square energy density. T00 energy density fluctuations determine phi.
Can I ask a question? Is there the equivalent of the adiabatic mode in such settings?
Yes.
With respect to the
we only have an adiabatic mode because we only have one gas.
So there is one fluctuating.
Right. Now you see, if you have, we have no anisotropic stress because there's one gas, so we actually have phi equals psi.
No, but you have the dilaton as well.
So yes.
It's an degree of freedom. So.
Yes. But you add, the dilaton has no anisotropic stress either. The dilaton would introduce, would, so with the dilaton you could set up an entropy perturbation mode.
Right. Just to clarify, the phi on the last line, is that still the perturbation phi?
Still the perturbation phi.
Okay, so the, this board doesn't have the dilaton phi on it.
Nope.
Okay.
Okay. So, list of concerns, I better not erase that.
Can I have a very fundamental question for you? The stress tensor, is that you find this coupling to the string metric or to the Einstein metric?
String, because it's a string gas. So see, I could write down the whole set of equations, but I don't think you'd gain very much. But I think I'll give you the method. So with the 0-0 equation, you can determine phi in terms of the energy density fluctuation. If you take the I not equal to J equation, that allows you to determine Hij in terms of the off-diagonal pressure perturbations. So the pressure perturbations determine the amplitude of the gravitational waves. The energy density perturbations determine the scalar metric fluctuations. So now the logic of the calculation is that you first you calculate delta M, the mass fluctuations, and the pressure fluctuations in the Hagedorn phase. And then, so you focus on the matter. Focusing on the matter is justified if you look at scales smaller than the Hubble radius. You fix K, your wave number. You identify the time, Ti of K, when the mode crosses the Hubble radius. And at Ti of K, you use the Einstein equations to determine the metric fluctuations. And then, third step, is you propagate phi and h on super Hubble scales. According to the usual theory of cosmological perturbations, which, for example, apply to this background, tells us that phi is constant. So that's a lot.
And then you still can transform to the Einstein frame to make to compare to experiment, right?
That's right. We transform to the Einstein frame. So put this in as part three.
But are there, at the same time that there's this stress energy tensor that's giving us perturbations in these metric modes, it's also putting perturbations in the dilaton?
Yep, that's right. If the dilaton is not fixed, so you have to include that as well.
And that becomes important in this lab.
That becomes important. And I'll comment on that when I talk about the results.
So, John, could you just restate about point step one? You said that's the M and P of the matter?
That's right.
And what matter is that?
String gas.
I keep getting confused when you use the word matter for string for some reason. Right. And basically, what's the input to get those fluctuations?
Okay, so string, so the thermodynamics of, so again, it's a gas of strings in thermal equilibrium. And so you can calculate the string thermodynamic fluctuations. And that was done in the early 1990s by Deo, Zhang, and Tang.
And these are fluctuations in the densities of energy? And
you actually, and this is a quantity to calculate. Because things are not extensive, you should calculate.
What does that represent?
The mass.
What mass?
You take a sphere of radius k inverse, and you calculate the root mean square mass fluctuations in this sphere. Delta m square is mean square
right.
mass fluctuation.
But the string input that tells you how to calculate that is what?
Okay, I'll give you the result. So the statement is that delta m square in a sphere of radius r has a holographic scaling. First of all, it's always equal to heat square specific heat. And the specific heat is r square divided by string length cubed temperature 1 divided by 1 minus temperature divided by Hadron temperature, if you're close to the Hadron temperature. So the heat scaling is specific heat proportional to r squared. That's a specific string thing. I highlight this.
Can I ask, what is the stress energy tensor that you start off with?
It's an ideal gas of strings characterized by energy density and pressure.
So the stress energy tensor looks like that of a perfect fluid?
So the fact that the slope that we discussed formerly is very horizontal there, that means that there is this.
Wait a minute. Okay. I'm sorry. I'll come to that. Okay. So you've been asking a lot of questions, and as a consequence, I'm going to eliminate, I'm going to skip a few steps of algebra, but not more than fits on one transparency. So I'm going to take this result and calculate the power spectrum of the scalar metric fluctuations, which is defined as k cubed, 5k, frame order k squared, which is equal to 16 pi squared g squared k squared, delta m squared, and r, using the Einstein equation. Effectively, what I've used is Poisson equation, the 0-0 Einstein equation.
You mean a different phi in there?
I mean the metric phi. There's only one phi. Only one phi.
Well, you're using
the Dilthey phi as well.
Yeah. That's all.
Okay, so now you see that the fact that you have an R square scaling exactly cancels this K square. So, result.
This is still in the string frame.
The phi is proportional.
Because phi is constant.
So.
Can you just
see the rescaling is independent of k.
Can you say why the cube became a square in the power of k?
Okay, so you're asking me to go through the steps?
No, because you say Poisson equation. Why the Poisson equation is filled by 1, not by 2, for instance?
Okay.
It's complicated?
No, it's not complicated. So when I go, I have to translate between position space and momentum space. To do that, I use delta n square of r equals k to the minus 3 delta rho of k square. This is the key. This is where the r power of k comes in. It's translation from Fourier space to momentum space. If, so you add that in as an exercise.
What does k has to do with r and this k has to do with r? But r in the beginning was the size of the box you were doing the calculation inside.
Okay.
And you're focusing on a fluctuation.
R total. I'm taking a subunit of radius r and I'm applying string thermodynamics to this box. And if you have a long, so let me emphasize, this scaling, specific heat proportion to r square, holds only if space is compact. It comes from the fact that there are winding strings. And you see, if there are winding strings in the entire box, they'll also wind through the subunit. There'll be long strings winding through the subunit. So modulo boundary conditions, I can apply the result which was used for the whole box to the subbox. But to be perfectly honest, I will add this as my concern, applying string statistical mechanics results to a subbox.
So when you mean a string gas, you mean a medium composed essentially of those extremely long strings? Because when you compute the mean fluctuation, you basically use that, like you just told us. So the string gas.
Well, basically, this. Deo Jain et al. Deo Jain et al. They took classical string thermodynamics, assuming that space was compact, and then they show that the long strings that dominate in that bath give you this dependence. So it's not that I took only part of the string. I took all the strings. But if space were not compact, there would be no long winding strings, and I wouldn't get the scaling. So this scaling only holds if the three spatial dimensions are compact. Okay, so now there was a question which I brushed off, actually postponed. So what I find is that the spectrum of power spectrum is effectively Planck length divided by string length to the fourth power. That's my amplitude times 1 over 1 minus temperature at the time that the mode exits the Hubble radius divided by 3 sub h. So if this curve up here is horizontal, all modes exit at the same time, at the same temperature, and you get a precise escape invariant spectrum. But if this curve has a slope, then it means that small scales, small length scales, will exit the Hubble radius at a slightly lower temperature, and therefore you get small deviations from scale invariants. First conclusion is scale invariant. But you have a slight red tilt. Small length scales have less power because this is smaller. So, and to determine the magnitude of the tilt, you have to determine the slope of that curve. I think that's a question you want to ask.
I was also wondering the fact that the equation of state of the dominant matter constituent changes could not affect the power spectrum. Like
yes, that will add in a k to the fifth
so there is
spectrum. On large scales, this will dominate. Okay, so now I can do the calculation for the gravitational waves as well. And I'm almost at the end of my talk. So the power spectrum of gravitational waves, which is defined as k cubed amplitude of the gravitational wave squared. This is determined by pressure fluctuations. And what I get is I get the same overall amplitude so, scaling variant. If you neglect this k dependence of this, you get a constant, but you get a small booter, which no inflationary model can give us. Or if you have to work very hard with inflationary models, you get a small blue tilt. And the reason you get a small blue tilt is the following. Large wavelengths exit deeper in the Hagedorn phase, where the pressure is less, and therefore less power. That's what explains the blue tilt.
So do you have an idea of the order of magnitude of the Hubble size when the mode we see today exits the horizon?
1 millimeter.
Still 1 millimeter. H is 1 millimeter.
Yeah, because this is 1 millimeter.
So everybody, all the various modes exit at 1 millimeter of the length.
Plus or minus 1 order of magnitude. Okay.
Do you have any idea how the temperatures varying when you have transition from a tiny dark phase to the radiation?
Yes, because this curve is known. The difficulty is to. So, what is.
Because
so, in principle, the answer is in principle it's calculable, but in practice not yet, because we don't have the exit from the Hagedorn phase under good control.
Because if it's driving like the way you have scales, then
it's scale invariant.
Then it's nothing scaling.
No, then it is scale invariant. If it's like this, it's scale invariant. This is the scale invariant limit. Because the temperature is the same for all k, and that's scale invariant. But if the process takes a long time, and if the curve is like this, then you get large deviations from scale invariant. Okay, so what I'll do now is I'll conclude, and then I'll briefly address the criticisms that have been raised a week ago against this work. So what we are proposing is a mechanism to generate a scale invariant spectrum of cosmological perturbations which does not involve inflation. We never claim, so this is an alternative in terms of structure formation. It does not solve some of the problems which inflation solves, some of the problems of standard Big Bang cosmology. It does not solve the flatness problem, because we've done all the calculations in spatial flat map. So we don't know that it won't work. But we've always said that we are assuming spatial flatness, we're not solving flatness problem. And then we have the entropy problem. We have to assume that space dots are blocked. So these are the two key things we have not solved. The horizon problem is trivially solved, provided we've solved the infinity problem.
And I think I missed something totally basic. Where do the strings go at the end of the whole story?
They go into matter. See this? The string loops represent ordinary matter.
So but there are strings wound around.
That's a prediction. There'll be a remnant. There'll be one cosmic superstring per Hubble volume. That's a prediction.
One was enough to produce all those fluctuations?
No, no, no. At late times, you get a scaling solution. See, we start with zero net winding number for the strings. So if you would have a completely static background, then all of the string winding modes would annihilate. But since space is expanding, once you've got rid of almost all of the string winding modes, there, by the Kibble argument, you will still have some remnant cosmic superstrings.
So do you mean an average of one per volume?
Average one per Hubble volume.
Doesn't it include the closing universe?
No, definitely not. It might provide signatures depending on what the string scale is.
Because here, see, it's like cosmic strings that are created at the end of the throw, and the tension is very small here.
No. So first of all, the structure formation mechanism is completely different from cosmic strings, because it's in this early phase where you have a gas of strings, dense gas of strings. It's producing metric fluctuation. It is a dominant component. The metric perturbations are squeezed.
If these are fundamental strings, their tension is of order of flying.
Well, there's a string scale in here, which we can determine from observations.
Actually, that can distort the cosmic matter effect on radiation.
Yes. That's why I said that's interesting. It's potentially testable. It's like in the work that Rob did. If we want to get the right amplitude of the power spectrum, we have to fix the string length to be substantially larger than the Planck length. 3, 4, 5 orders of magnitude. That exactly puts you into the interesting ballpark.
Isn't that a problem for this whole story? Because normally you have to assume that the string length is less than the Planck length to describe strings semi-classically in the gravitational background.
Okay, you are now coming to this. Created this question.
And then maybe a second question, which is maybe less tenuous, but it looks like the amplitude of gravitational and matter fluctuations is the same. Isn't that already ruled out by experiment?
So the ratio of tensor modes to scalar modes is smaller than 0.2 now. Well, the amplitude, you see, we are very close to the Hadron temperature. Very close to the Hadron temperature means that this is a huge factor, and on the very small factor. So no, the ratio is actually going to be substantially smaller than one. And if we had good control of the background, the ratio could be predicted. So anyway, so this is an alternative to producing a scalar invariant spectrum of cosmological perturbations, which does not involve inflation. Scalars of interest, their physical wavelength is always much larger than string scale. You predict a spectrum of tensor modes, which is also scaling invariant, but which has a blue tilt. So that's a distinguishing testable feature. So now, there are a lot of problems that we've listed here, and there are many more, but I just want to address three problems which were brought out in this quite long paper by Carlotta, Kaufmann, Linde, and Buchner. Problem one, which they mentioned, difference between string frame and Einstein frame. Yes, there's a difference between the string frame and the Einstein frame. We've taken this into account. Objection number two is that in order to get this scenario, you need violation of the energy condition because you have to have static universe going into expanding universe. Yes, this is crucial to the scenario. We need this. This is central. This is expected. This is the model. This is a nice feature of the model. Then comes the objection that we've computed the gravity wave spectrum wrong, that we should do a Green's function analysis. And doing the Green's function analysis, you don't get the scaled down spectrum, but you get a thermal spectrum, which has no power at large wavelengths. Well, in a Green's function calculation, there are initial conditions, which you have to set. They set zero gravitational waves initial conditions. If you have a long quasi-static Hagedorn phase, those are the wrong boundary values. So the Green's function. And then the last objection, most serious objection, is we start with a matter power spectrum, which is not scale invariant. Matter fluctuations are not scale invariant. We deduce scale invariant metric fluctuations. On large wavelengths, matter is proportional to metric. So therefore, we cannot get a scale invariant spectrum of metric fluctuations. Well, the thing that's wrong about that logic is that on super Hopper scales, you cannot calculate the matter perturbations. That's a gauge invariant statement. You have to start on sub Hopper scales with the matter perturbations, calculate the metric perturbations when you cross Hopper radius, infer what, in a particular gauge, the matter perturbations are on super Hopper scales. So what I've done is I've summarized in three sentences the three main sections of this paper. And I think these are the serious objections, not the ones in that paper. So, thanks.
Okay, further questions? So what provided the violation of the energy condition in your model?
Oh, we have a different background. Not the Einstein equations.
But do you have the... I didn't catch whether the string theory tells you that you do have such a violation.
Or just a we are missing. We don't have... But I do not know of a nice effective action to use.
Right, so you just dream it up and you hope that string theory would deliver that.
But you have a stress energy tensor. Can you look at it and tell me you violated the energy condition?
No,
energy conditions are conditions on a stress tensor. You're using a stress tensor.
No. So you see, the stress energy satisfies the energy condition.
It's the curvature corrections and effective action, I think, that they're hoping.
See, if you just take general relativity and that stress tensor which we calculated, you don't get this evolution of the background.
Right, but you have...
Our stress energy is nice. Our stress energy tensor does not violate energy, any energy conditions.
Okay, I haven't read rather the long paper, and so I'm not sure what the objection is.
Okay, let me write down
one question. You could take your theory, you could put it in Einstein's frame, there would be a stress energy tensor, which I would assume is the one I should test to see if it violates any conditions or not.
Right.
And so you could do that and tell me that it does or it doesn't. Well,
presumably it does, because you always get a wrong sign kinetic term for the dilaton.
No, let's be clear. Is it the higher curvature terms that you're hoping will provide this violation that you haven't written down the action, or is it just everything has been written down?
So, what you usually write down is this H dot, which is determined by P plus rho. Now, minus. So, we need H dot, according to the picture which I drew, time scale factor, H dot is positive. We have a P plus rho, which satisfies all the usual energy conditions. It can, if you use Einstein equations, with the stress energy tensor of the string gas, we don't get this far.
How can you use
so how is that equation effectively changed, I think, is the question.
Yes, okay. So we need to, our background has to be described as something completely different.
Well, maybe, but I mean, as Rod said, you could write everything in Einstein language, and I could, I'll get presumably that equation modified in some manner.
Yes, modified.
How is it modified? Can you easily write it down?
No, I cannot write. I cannot write it down.
At all?
No,
or just not easily?
Well, let me guess again.
Yeah.
So that's a curve you drew for the Einstein frame metric.
Yeah.
No, is it the Einstein frame metric or the string frame?
Both.
So,
you see what happens if you look at the TC and TR, what happens is that one metric goes like this. One metric starts growing here, the other metric starts growing here. So this phase,
why can't you write down the modification of that equation? Is it just technically?
No, you see. If you have this curve that comes from string thermodynamics, R, T, so you don't want to describe the dynamics here by adding some higher power terms to the dynamics which you know describes this. Because it's like if you're looking at higher curvature, higher corrections to a Taylor expansion around the wrong point. So, I mean, I can...
If I'm in Einstein frame, though, is it central to the... Is the problem they've identified that this curve starts going up in the strong coupling regime, and in fact...
No, they have not identified any problem in that sense. What they are saying is that Einstein gravity does not describe the A of T curve that we want.
Okay, but there was some discussion just now of violations of energy conditions, and so if I was in Einstein frame, would I say that the energy conditions were violated at T equals TC? Is that a fair statement? Or are they violated all through the weak coupling regime?
No, they're not violated. They're violated only before TC.
Okay.
Only before TC.
This is strong coupling, and there you're making a very blatant assumption somewhere about phi being constant.
Yep.
So
exactly.
That's probably central then.
Exactly.
To this.
Exactly.
Okay. Can I ask you, I saw two power spectra, but I thought you promised me you were also going to calculate one for the dilettante. Did you, or did I miss
it? Oh, I'm just telling you that is not scale invariant. That the dilettante gets a k to the fifth power spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm not educated enough.
Let me be careful. I don't. If you do a calculation, let's imagine that you don't allow us this strongly coupled Hartmann phase. So if you don't allow us to use this strongly coupled Hartmann phase, which is central to the whole picture, then the statement is that you do not get the scaling down spectrum. Because the dilettante messes things up. Because then the Poisson equation, which reads k squared phi equals delta rho, gets correction terms due to the dilettante, phi dot squared. And so what happens is that the non-scale invariant spectrum of this induces a non-scale invariant spectrum of this, and through a different equation you get a non-scale invariant spectrum of this. This k squared does not become a factor anymore. So it's only this sense that I've promised you a power spectrum for the dilettante.
But if I allow you that strong coupling, or your assumption about the strong coupling phase,
and now you want to...
There is some power spectrum
for the dilettante.
For the dilettante, and it was going to, well, it was actually going to do two things. One of them was it was going to affect the transformation. When I look at now the power spectrum of the Einstein frame metric, the perturbations there, it's going to be some convolution of the vector you like and this one?
It's going to, yeah.
And are you, is it subdominant somehow, or is that why we don't care? Or?
Okay, we calculated the metric perturbations directly.
Yeah.
And in our calculation, there's also the result for the dilaton perturbations. But it's not more, I just can't remember the exact result. It doesn't mess things up. And I don't remember if it's scaling around or if it's possible. Yeah, that is, if I do the calculation in a weakly coupled Hagedorn phase. In the strongly coupled Hagedorn phase, the result might be different.
Well, but in the strongly coupled phase, you say what the dilaton perturbation is, because you don't know what the mechanism that's producing the dilaton. You don't know what the equations of motion are.
Okay, but so when I calculate perturbations in the strongly coupled Hagedorn phase, what I like is we are calculating fluctuations on such large scales that we can use the effective Einstein equations. And using that, we can also get the dilaton fluctuations.
Since we're already a little bit over time, I would suggest that anybody who's still interested in discussing this is welcome to stay. And we officially end the session for today, and let's just thank God.